York. This is Democracy Now!
What stood out to you about what Mr. Floyd was saying when you saw him on the ground?
When he kept saying, "I can't breathe," and when he said, "Mama, you're killing me."
Jurors in Minneapolis have heard another day of dramatic testimony in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd last May. For 3 days, witnesses have described the horror of seeing Chauvin kneel on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds.
At some point, did you make a 911 call?
That is correct. I did call the police on the police.
And why did you do that?
Because I believe I witnessed a murder.
And so you felt the need to call the police?
I felt the need to call the police on the police.
We'll air excerpts of the trial and speak to Rashad Robinson of Color of Change and Mill Reeves of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black-owned newspaper in Minnesota. Then we go to Brazil, where over 66,000 people died in the month of March as COVID cases skyrocketed, leaving Brazil's hospital system on the verge of collapse. This comes as Brazil faces a growing political crisis. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Jurors in Minneapolis have heard another day of dramatic testimony in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who's on trial for killing George Floyd last May by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. One of the most dramatic moments of the trial Wednesday occurred when Charles McMillian, who witnessed George Floyd's death last year, rewatched the police body cam clip of George Floyd begging for his life after he was handcuffed by police. McMillian broke down in tears and was unable to speak for several moments. Jurors were also shown police body cam footage of the bystanders who attempted to save George Floyd's life as Officer Chauvin kneeled on his neck. After headlines, we'll air clips from the murder trial and go to Minneapolis for the latest on the police killing of George Floyd. In California, 4 people were killed and a 5th seriously wounded Wednesday evening when a gunman opened fire on an Orange County office complex. A child was among the dead. Police say the gunman was wounded during an exchange of fire with officers and taken into custody. Wednesday's massacre follows recent mass shootings at 3 Atlanta spas that killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women, and a killing spree at a Boulder, Colorado supermarket that killed 10. President Joe Biden's defending his $2.3 trillion jobs and infrastructure plan against progressive critics who say it doesn't go nearly far enough toward combating climate change. Biden promoted his plan during a trip to Pittsburgh Wednesday.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago.
Biden's plan includes hundreds of billions of dollars for investments in energy-efficient buildings, electric vehicles, better public transit, and R&D into new technologies to combat the climate crisis. In response, the youth-led Sunrise Movement called on lawmakers to support Biden's infrastructure plan as a step towards a Green New Deal, but added in a tweet, quote, "Joe Biden, this is unacceptable. Your proposal needs to include at least $10 trillion on infrastructure if you want to meet the scale of this moment," unquote. The United States recorded more than 67,000 new coronavirus infections Wednesday and over 1,000 deaths. COVID-19 cases are continuing to rise in a majority of states despite one of the world's fastest vaccine rollouts. On Wednesday, conservative justices on Wisconsin's Supreme Court struck down a statewide mask mandate ordered by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Pfizer says its COVID-19 vaccine provides protection for at least 6 months after a second dose. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said Wednesday, vaccinated people do not appear to be able to carry or transmit the coronavirus to others. Meanwhile, Johnson & Johnson says 15 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine were contaminated and will have to be thrown out, delaying shipments of J&J's one-dose vaccine across the United States. The company blamed human error at an emergent biosolutions manufacturing plant in Baltimore, Maryland. In Brazil, cemeteries around the city of Sao Paulo are holding funerals into the night to handle a record surge of coronavirus deaths. About 66,000 Brazilians died of COVID-19 in March, with epidemiologists warning the worst is yet to come. In India, public health officials are warning a Hindu religious festival in the Ganges River city of Haridwar will become a massive super spreader event. More than a million people a day are expected to pack the festival despite a recent massive surge of COVID-19 cases across India. Turkey's reimposed weekend lockdowns and will limit gatherings during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan amidst a third wave of coronavirus cases. French President Emmanuel Macron has ordered a third nationwide lockdown, with schools ordered shut for 3 weeks. In the UK, health officials say half the population now has antibodies against COVID-19, either from an infection or vaccination. Britain has one of the world's fastest vaccine rollouts. Meanwhile, Yemen received its first shipment of 360,000 COVID-19 vaccine doses Wednesday. Officially, Yemen has recorded 4,000 coronavirus cases and less than 900 deaths, but doctors say a silent surge is underway. Yemen is experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis more than 6 years after the start of the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war. This is a doctor at a COVID-19 treatment center in Aden.
The center is overwhelmed. We need oxygen and to expand intensive care across all provinces. The two most important things is funding and more staff. We need more staff because the rise in cases is not normal.
The World Resources Institute is warning global deforestation jumped 12% last year in a blow to efforts to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. The group estimates about 10 million acres of tropical forest were destroyed in 2020. That's an area roughly the size of Switzerland. Most of the destruction occurred in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. Deforestation also spiked in Cameroon and Colombia. A federal court in New York has sentenced Tony Hernandez, the brother of the Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez, to life in prison for drug trafficking. Tony Hernandez, a former member of Congress in Honduras, was convicted in 2019 on wide-ranging charges, including massive bribing schemes. U.S. prosecutors say he was also involved in at least two murders and that Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez was a co-conspirator in the, quote, state-sponsored drug trafficking. In Hong Kong, a court convicted media tycoon Jimmy Lai, veteran politician Martin Lee, and five other notable pro-democracy activists for participating in an unauthorized peaceful protest in 2019. They could face up to 5 years behind bars. Hong Kong politician Sid Ho is another one of the convicted activists.
The freedom of information, the freedom of expression are now banned in Hong Kong. And that does nobody any good. It is only a deterrent of our progress.
Here in the United States, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the position taken by the Trump administration that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous from China and should not benefit from preferential trade terms. In media news, the BBC's China correspondent John Sudworth has left Beijing for Taiwan after describing increasing threats, surveillance and obstruction from Chinese authorities. Sudworth has won awards for his reporting on the plight of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. In California, federal authorities have charged a man, Jose Cruz Noguez, with smuggling related to the deadly crash that killed 13 Mexican and Guatemalan nationals near the U.S.-Mexico border last month. The Pentagon has officially reversed the Trump administration's ban on transgender people serving in the military. The new policies will allow soldiers and officers to serve according to their self-identified gender. Microsoft has won a Pentagon contract worth nearly $22 billion to produce 120,000 augmented reality headsets for U.S. Army soldiers. Microsoft's HoloLens headsets were first developed for video gamers, combining virtual images with real-world views. The headsets provide a real-time heads-up display that uses artificial intelligence to suggest targets for soldiers' weapons. In 2019, more than 100 Microsoft engineers wrote in an open letter, quote, "We are alarmed that Microsoft is working to provide weapons technology to the U.S. military, helping one country's government increase lethality using tools we built. We did not sign up to develop weapons, and we demand a say in how our work is used," unquote. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has signed a bill barring jails and prisons from holding people in solitary confinement for more than 15 consecutive days. It also prohibits solitary confinement for children and people with disabilities. The new law is set to take effect in 2022. Virginia Democratic Governor Ralph Northam signed major voting rights legislation Wednesday, expanding access to the ballot box and enshrining protections against voter suppression, discrimination, and intimidation. The move comes amidst ongoing Republican voter suppression efforts around the country and 8 years after the Supreme Court gutted the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Over 70 black executives signed an open letter calling on companies to speak out against dozens of voter suppression bills like the one passed in Georgia last week. Published as a full-page ad in the New York Times, the business leaders write, quote, "When it comes to protecting the rights of all Americans to vote, there can be no middle ground." President Biden says he would strongly support MLB, that's Major League Baseball players, if they decide to move the upcoming All-Star game from Atlanta to protest Georgia's new voter suppression laws. Meanwhile, the CEOs for Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola finally came out in opposition to Georgia's clampdown on voting rights nearly a week after the legislation was signed and amidst mounting public scrutiny and threats to boycott the Atlanta-based companies over their inaction. And in Texas, the Criminal Appeals Court has agreed to review the case of Crystal Mason, a black resident and mother who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for filling out a provisional ballot in 2016. Mason had no idea she was not allowed to vote due to her criminal record and her ballot was never counted. She spoke with Democracy Now! In 2018.
I just feel right now that the system failed me. You get out, you rehabilitate yourself, you get a good job, you go to school, you graduate from school, you're doing everything right. So why would I go and vote to go back to prison? Why would I do something like that to lose my kids again, to start all over again?
You can see the full interview at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host, Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hello, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, jurors in Minneapolis have heard another day of dramatic testimony in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's on trial for killing George Floyd last May by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Chauvin, who is white, is charged with second and third degree murder as well as manslaughter for killing George Floyd, a 46-year-old black father. Floyd's death sparked international protests calling for racial justice. Floyd's arrest and death on May 25th last year occurred after the Cup Foods convenience store called the police, accusing Floyd of using a counterfeit $20 bill. To this day, it's not known if Floyd even knew he'd used a counterfeit money. Moments after police arrived at the scene, Officer Thomas Lane pointed a gun at Floyd and then pulled him out of a parked car, cursing at him. On Wednesday, a teenage clerk at the store named Christopher Martin told jurors during questioning he felt guilty for reporting the fake $20 bill to his manager, who called the police on Floyd.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
One of the most moving moments of the trial came Wednesday when Charles McMillan, who also witnessed George Floyd's death, rewatched a police body cam clip of George Floyd begging for his life after he was handcuffed by police. A warning to our audience, this clip contains graphic video of police violence.
I can't breathe.
Stop moving.
Mama.
One of the front pouches.
Mama.
On my right side back.
Mama.
You're the best guy.
All right. Oh, my God.
So now you go to jail.
I can't believe. I can't believe, man.
Can we stop it right here, please?
Mama, look.
Mr. McMillan, do you need a minute? Just give you a moment, Mr. McMillan. I'm not sure if there's water as well. If you need a break to get some water, let me know. We can take a break.
After the break, the 61-year-old African-American bystander, Charles McMillan, returned to be questioned about what he saw when police killed George Floyd.
What stood out to you about what Mr. Floyd was saying when you saw him on the ground?
When he kept saying, I can't breathe, and when he said, Mama, you're killing me.
During the trial Wednesday, jurors also heard a recording of Charles McMillan approaching Officer Derek Chauvin moments after George Floyd's limp body was put in an ambulance. McMillan told Chauvin, quote, I don't respect what you did.
Can you advise the fire department if they're still with you? They need to go to 36th
Park
to assist with the
police.
But I feel
respect
for
you.
That's one person's opinion.
But
no,
we got to control this guy because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, and I thought he didn't get in the car.
Looks like he's probably on something.
On Wednesday, jurors were also shown police body cam footage of the bystanders who attempted to save George Floyd's life as Officer Chauvin kneeled on his neck.
Okay, can you indulge
the officer? He's not responsive right now. He's not responsive right now, bro.
Does he have a pulse?
No, bro, look at him. He's not responsive right now, bro.
Check for a pulse.
Bro, are you serious? He's going to just let him sit there with that on his neck, bro?
Let me see a pulse.
Is he breathing right now? Check his pulse.
How long do we have this conversation?
Check his pulse. Okay. Check his pulse, Tao. Tao, check his pulse, bro.
Don't do drugs, bro.
What is that? What do you think that is? You saw you call what he doing okay?
Get back
up. You call what he doing okay?
Are you really a firefighter?
Yes, I am from Minneapolis.
Okay, then get on the sidewalk.
You call. You think that's okay? Check his pulse.
Check his right pulse.
Check his pulse.
Get back on the sidewalk.
The man ain't moved yet, bro.
Okay, where?
Minneapolis!
Okay,
bro, you're a bum, bro.
One of the eyewitnesses to George Floyd's murder, the mixed martial artist Donald Williams, told prosecutor Matthew Frank he called 911 after seeing Chauvin put Floyd in what Williams had earlier called a blood choke.
At some point, did you make a 911 call?
That is correct. I did call the police.
Right. And why did you do that?
Because I believe I witnessed a murder.
And so you felt a need to call the police?
Yeah, I felt the need to call the police on the police.
Another one of the eyewitnesses was an off-duty firefighter and EMT named Genevieve Hansen, who was out for a walk. On Tuesday, she told prosecutor Matthew Frank she wanted to check George Floyd's pulse and give him chest compressions, but she was prevented from doing so by the police.
I was really concerned about, I thought his face looked puffy and swollen, which would happen if you are putting a grown man's weight on someone's neck. I noticed some fluid coming from what looked like George Floyd's body. And in a lot of cases, we see a patient release their bladder when they die. I can't tell you exactly where the fluid was coming from, but that's where my mind went. He wasn't moving.
What's the point of doing chest compressions?
Pumping the blood for somebody that's not doing that themselves, trying to get a pulse back.
And were you able to do that, any of those steps?
No, sir.
Why weren't you able to do any of that?
Because the officers didn't let me in to the scene. I also offered, in my memory, I offered to walk them through it, or told them, if he doesn't have a pulse, you need to start compressions, and that wasn't done either.
Are these things that you wanted to do?
It's what I would have done for anybody.
When you couldn't do that, how did that make you feel?
Totally distressed.
Were you frustrated?
Yes.
Ms. Hansen, you know, as I told you, we can take our time, so feel free to just take a minute. And need a drink of water? Go ahead.
Okay.
How were you doing that, trying to get the officers to focus on you and get help?
In my memory, I tried different tactics of calm and reasoning. I tried to be assertive. I pled and was desperate.
That's Genevieve Hansen, a Minneapolis firefighter and EMT. Jurors on Tuesday also heard from Darnella Frazier. She was just 17 years old when she used her cell phone to film the killing of George Floyd. Her image was not broadcast on the court television feed because she was a minor at the time of Floyd's death.
I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe, please get off of me. I can't breathe." He cried for his mom. He was in pain. It seemed like he knew it was over for him. He was terrified. He was suffering. This was a cry for help.
Now, Mr. Nelson asked you a few questions about your video going viral and how that's changed your life. Remember that at the end?
Yes.
Would you tell the ladies and gentlemen how you're viewing, experiencing what happened to George Floyd has affected your life?
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father, I have a black brother, I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life. But it's like, it's not what I should have done. It's what he should have done.
Thank you.
Now, 18 years old, Darnella Frazier who filmed the police killing of George Floyd. When we come back, we're going to speak to Mel Reeves of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black-owned newspaper in Minnesota, plus Rashad Robinson of Color of Change. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we've reported, jurors in Minneapolis have heard another day of dramatic testimony in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd last May. For 3 days, witnesses have described the horror of seeing Chauvin kneel on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Chauvin, who is white, is charged with second and third degree murder, as well as manslaughter for killing George Floyd, a 46-year-old black father. Floyd's death sparked international protests calling for racial justice. For more, we go to Minneapolis to speak with Mel Reeves, the community editor at the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the oldest black-owned newspaper in the state covering the trial of Chauvin, also longtime human rights and anti-police violence activists. Also with us, Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Mel Reeves. You're right there in Minneapolis. The horror of this trial, as we see footage that we have seen over the last almost year, and also new footage. But one of the things that comes out most powerfully is exactly what the defense attorney seemed not to want to have proven. He talked about an angry mob. You have each of these people of conscience, the 61-year-old bystander, McMillan, the EMT and firefighter who tried to help, the 17-year-old at the time, teenager who filmed the whole thing that we saw, the 9-year-old little girl. Can you talk about what this community, not even knowing each other particularly that night, what it means to hear their testimony and their grief?
Unlike the way the defense tried to paint them, they come off as real human beings. They witnessed the crime, and what we saw, what they witnessed is what we saw in the film, and their testimony proves that they saw something that was outrageous, and you know, they wanted to do something about it. It's unfortunate that the defense is trying to portray them as some wild mob.
And Rashad Robinson, could you say more about what the defense has been arguing? Color of Change released a press release titled, "Minneapolis jurors, spectators must remember that Derek Chauvin is on trial and not George Floyd."
Playbook. This is the playbook from police unions who are paying for the defense, who have injected well over $50 million since 2012 into elections to actually help to dictate what prosecutors and mayors and other folks who are responsible for police accountability do. And this is what they do in trial after trial, is work to put the community and work to put the victim on trial, to make the victim someone who deserved to be killed. This is a situation where we have video, and this is a situation where we have a series of witnesses that are deeply, deeply credible. And this is a situation where we've had uprisings that happened all throughout the summer. But I do want people who are watching, who are listening, to remember that we don't always have these situations. And that should not be the prerequisite for whether or not we have a system that provides justice, or we even have a situation where we think justice could be possible. But that is what the defense is doing, because it is a playbook that actually sort of draws on all of the deep levels of racism, all of the ways in which the system is not broken, but is operating exactly the way it was designed, to let police officers off and to put Black people on trial, regardless of whether we are victim or perpetrator.
Mel Reeves, could you respond to what Rashad said and also elaborate on the concerns you've expressed about the jury selection process?
I'm glad you asked that, because like Rashad and some, you know, I'm not just a writer and journalist. I'm an activist. So I've been on the ground of actually organizing against police violence. In fact, I pushed back against folks saying that the fight was just a fight for racial justice. It was a fight for justice, and it was a fight for that, demanding very clearly prosecution of the police. We've been trying to hold the police accountable here. What's interesting is, yeah, let me talk about the trial thing that you asked, but I want to make this point to folks that people in the community don't have any real faith in the court system right now. When we poll people, most folks have some real doubts about the outcome of the trial. And part of that is fueled by the fact that the police in Minneapolis and St. Paul have not changed their behavior. Just last week, there was a situation where the police grabbed the wrong young person. People in the neighborhood trying to say bring that to attention. And in the process of them dealing with this young person, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. A Minneapolis policeman, right on video, jumped on this kid, punched him with the full force, and jumped on the ground and started punching him. And in St. Paul, with a no-knock warrant, somebody entered the house to grab this woman's 18-year-old son. And in the process, they choked her 11-year-old son. And so the question is, why would this continue in this environment? All right. And so what we're starting to suspect is that on some level here, that the police are provoking our folks. But getting back to your original question, we wrote about this, and we're trying to do a day by day journal in our paper, Spokesman Quarter. I wrote about the fact that even the system of juries, even the court process, is biased. The juror number 76, we keep referring to him as 76, is a black man from South Minneapolis. He had experienced police harassment. In fact, he said at one point during his voir dire that in his neighborhood, whenever a black person was killed, the police would ride down the street playing "Another One Bites the Dust" and attempting to antagonize the community. So the question is, and so he was rejected, even though, like all the other jurors, especially the white jurors, he was able to say to the judge that, yes, I think I can be fair and impartial. And our question was, well, why did not the court system, remember, the prosecution did not find him acceptable, as well as the defense, nor the judge, right? So the system said that a black man with a lived African-American experience did not qualify for the jury. So it raises questions about, what do they really want on this jury? Remember, we have four people on the jury who have either relatives or friends that are policemen. So it makes you wonder, like I said, I've said to people all the time who say, well, can Derek Chauvin get a fair trial? Derek Chauvin's getting a much fairer trial than either you or I would.
I wanted to ask you about this gathering of eyewitnesses, going back to that point, Mel, people who did not know each other, and how incredibly restrained they were. I mean, they were saying, he is not breathing. You have the EMT saying, let me take his pulse, or at least you take his pulse. But what you also see is, for the first time, you hear the police officers speaking. You hear Chauvin's voice afterwards. When Mr. McMillan says to him that he doesn't respect him, why did he do that? You hear how controlled Chauvin is, clearly not upset. This is as the body is taken away. And you see Lane at the beginning, Officer Lane. I mean, the charge was, at least the call they got, was that a counterfeit bill was passed. Not at all clear that Floyd knew that that $20 wasn't real. And that he pulls a gun on him immediately, cursing him out, saying effing this and effing that, which is, of course, Floyd responds, please don't kill me. But this level of enormous pressure from the beginning that we're seeing in these videos.
You didn't finish for the question, but I'll take off from there. What you said sounded like you read our update from yesterday. If you go to spokesrecorder.com, you'll see the update I wrote. And that was the point that I raised as well, that on some level, what you saw was a microcosm of U.S. policing, of how police operate when they run into black folks. If you notice, he pulled a gun on him right away. You know, initially when I saw it, I thought, well, maybe George Floyd was acting a little rationally. But on second thought and looking at it again, it made sense that he might have been nervous and paranoid. It makes sense for a black man in the U.S. to be nervous when the police. In fact, it makes sense even for a brown person or even a white working class on some level, especially if somebody pulls a gun on you. I thought you're right. It was odd that Chauvin had just killed a man and he walked away with little affect. In fact, the piece I wrote, I talked about how Charles McMillan was a hero, because I don't think I would have walked up on a cop who just killed somebody and talked to him and told him what I thought. And McMillan was a real hero. He walked up on him and said he didn't respect what he did. And Chauvin almost appeared to be preparing his defense already, because he was saying that, well, he was a big guy and we had to, you know, and then he was on drugs. So it almost seemed as if he realized, at least he did realize he had done something wrong. And so he's trying to prepare a defense. But, you know, all throughout the trial, in fact, in the opening, both the defense and the prosecution were trying to make it clear to the jury and all of us watching that this trial is not about the police, the system of policing or justice at all, or politics. And as I wrote, nothing could be further from the truth. It is about politics. The system of policing is on trial. You can see now how the police operate when they run into black people. They treated the true bystander, they treated the bystanders like criminals. They treated the two folks that were in George Floyd's car who had done nothing wrong. And they said to the police, hey, he had given us a ride. And they said, he's a nice guy. And then the cops were trying to figure out something wrong with George. They said, well, he might be struggling with something. So anyway, while the defense is trying to paint George as this crazed person on drugs, that's not what comes across. He comes across as somebody like a lot of us who are a bit afraid of the police, because why wouldn't you be? These guys killed thousands of people, not just black people. They killed thousands of people. They brutalized folks. And what people see on TV or what people who live in the suburbs experience is not the lived experience of most people of color in major U.S. cities. So the whole thing was disturbing. And Chauvin's response after it was disturbing. But I think because you keep referring to the bystanders, you make it good. I think the bystanders are acting like human beings. And you say they were restrained. They had no choice. They were actually threatened. Chauvin, while he had his knee on Floyd's neck, actually threatened to pull out his mace on Donald Williams. So the crowd was restrained, but only because the police restrained them. Clearly, part of why the witnesses are so upset is because they could not help George Floyd. They knew he needed help. And it just shows you the insanity of the system of police. You know, sometimes when a black person is killed, the police say they had the saying NHI, no human involved. After watching that body camera yesterday, it looked to me as if there was no human involved in dealing with George Floyd. None of the police operated with any kind of compassion or empathy. None of them. In fact, when you look at the video again, I have no idea why they pulled George Floyd out of that car and laid him on the ground. I have no idea. What were they trying to do? I mean, I don't understand. The defense doesn't have much of an argument. Those police, including what I call the Three Stooges, all look very indifferent to the plight of George Floyd. It almost looks like, and this may sound a little hyperbolic, but it almost looks like they were trying to kill him. Alexander King had his knee in George Floyd's back. That's what the video revealed yesterday. But not only was Derek Chauvin pressing on his neck with his knee with a full weight, but Alexander King, who's a pretty good-sized guy, had his knee in George Floyd's back, and he didn't take his knee off until the paramedics arrived. I think then it arrived. And if you listen to them talking, they never actually are caring. George Floyd says, I can't breathe. The only time he responded was somebody said to him, well, you're talking. I mean, they were totally indifferent to the plight of this human being. I mean, this is an indictment of the U.S. police system, if I've ever seen one.
Rashad Robinson, could you respond to that, that the system of policing here is on trial, and talk specifically about the role of police unions? Color of Change has led campaigns to expose police unions. So could you explain what role you think police unions play in enabling violence of this kind?
Well, it's a, you know, it's a multi-part strategy from police unions. On one hand, you end up with, you know, the unions working to sort of lobby for policies like qualified immunity and others, right? You know, qualified immunity was just sort of outlawed in New York City, but around the country, what that actually means is that police officers are not civilly liable for any anything that they do on the job. And then what that amounts to is that police unions can build up these sort of big funds to pay for the legal defense of someone like Chauvin and police officers around the country, and they never have to raise money to actually deal with civil defense. And so they're only dealing with a really small level of liability. Police officers can treat us, can treat our communities like enemy combatants and be able to sort of continue to go on with their job. They also go about, you know, making sure that if police officers are fired for something, that they can get jobs in other cities and that they are shielded, right? The police officer that killed 12-year-old Tamir Rice is working someplace else, and we don't even know what that police officer looks like, right? We know what Tamir Rice looked like before he died, but we do not know what that police officer looks like. We watch as they inject millions upon millions of dollars into elections to be able to sway sort of the political sort of prospect of any type of accountability. And all of these things work into concert to be able to give police officers a type of shields that no other industry has in our country. Despite everything that we know about policing and all the challenges of violent policing, this is not something that we can simply reform around the edges. And this is when we have deep conversations about what does it mean to divest from this type of policing and invest in communities, right? All around the country, instead of investing in mental health, we send someone with a gun to deal with someone that has, you know, potentially, possibly passed a $20 bill that's counterfeit off or written a bad check, instead of actually sending someone that can de-escalate a situation. And this is what's at stake. Police officers are not incentivized to de-escalate. They know there will be protection in the end. And one quick story that really animates all of this is back in 2016, I was at a meeting at the White House with then President Obama and a number of other leaders from civil rights, mayors, police chiefs, folks from the police unions. It was shortly after Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and the Dallas police officers were all killed. And in that meeting, I talked about racial profiling, as well as many other folks like Brian Stevenson and others. And the head of the executive director of the Fraternal Order of Police, Joe Pasco, responded, interrupted me as I was talking about an incident of racial profiling that impacted me personally, and said, all of this talk of racial profiling is new to me. This is the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, not arguing that maybe the policies we're trying to advance around police accountability are too much. He was essentially gaslighting us that police, that racial profiling doesn't even exist. And so this is what we are up against in terms of these sort of institutions that have a tremendous amount of money, put it into basically protecting police at the expense of safety and justice for all of our communities. And so politicians who accept police union money can't come to the community another day and say that they support safety and justice, because what they are supporting is secret societies that are intent on protecting people who kill us and letting them off, helping them keep their pensions. Derek Chauvin, as a result of the work of the police union, will stand to capture well over $1 million in his pension. What kind of accountability is that? And what kind of system is that with the people that our tax dollars go to protect and serve us, are incentivized not to protect and serve us, but are incentivized to control us, to harm us, And they know at the end of the day that every sort of barrier will be put in place to prevent any type of accountability along the way.
I want to thank you both for being with us. And, of course, we're going to have you both back on. This is a trial that is expected to last several weeks. Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. And, Mel, we're going to link to your articles and the other articles in your newspaper. Mel Reeves, community editor at the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, longtime human rights and anti-police violence activist. Next up, we go to Brazil, where over 66,000 people died in the month of March alone, as COVID cases skyrocket and the hospital system is on the verge of collapse, as the country continues to face a growing political crisis with the far-right president, Bolsonaro. We'll go to Sao Paulo to speak with a Brazilian doctor who's coordinating Brazil's largest scientific COVID-19 task force. Stay with us.
Eu vou com minha turma esperar na areia. Eu vou com minha turma esperar na areia. Vamos todo mundo ver a chegada da baleia. Vamos todo mundo ver a chegada da baleia. Em Barcarena foi um grande feriado, tudo pra ver essa baleia falada. Com tanta gente pra pegar ela no mar, mas pra pôr ela em terra veio arrastar. Eu vou com minha turma esperar na areia. Eu vou com minha turma esperar na areia. Vamos todo mundo ver a chegada da baleia. Vamos todo mundo ver a chegada da baleia. Tanta canoa, tanto carro e avião, tanto fotógrafo da rádio e televisão, e tanta carne espalhada pelo chão. Todos que saiam de lá com seu pedacinho na mão.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to the mounting public health and political crisis in Brazil, which now accounts for about a quarter of all COVID-19 daily deaths worldwide, more than any other country. About 66,000 people died in the month of March as cases skyrocketed, leaving Brazil's hospital system on the verge of collapse. Brazil suffered a record close to 4,000 deaths in a single day Tuesday. Its overall death toll of more than 321,000 is surpassed only by the United States. This comes as far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro faces intense pressure to abandon his opposition to vaccines, lockdowns, and mask wearing. Brazil is also facing a major political crisis. Earlier this week, the heads of Brazil's army, navy, air force all quit in an unprecedented move, a day after Bolsonaro ousted his defense minister as part of a broader cabinet shakeup. For more, we go to Sao Paulo, Brazil, where we're joined by Dr. Miguel Nicolelas, professor of neurobiology at Duke University, former coordinator of the largest scientific COVID-19 task force in Brazil. Doctor, welcome to Democracy Now! Sao Paulo is suffering so horrendously right now, like the rest of Brazil. Can you describe what's happening?
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be with you guys today. Well, São Paulo is the epicenter of the Brazilian tragedy right now. It's like being a battlefield. Hospitals are full to capacity. The governor has tried to manage the crisis unsuccessfully. And today we, woke up with the news that cemeteries are filling up. And basically, you have the sense that you're in some sort of battlefield back in World War II. Because, supplies are running down, doctors are basically at the limit what they can do right now, and there's very little hope at the end of the tunnel right now in Brazil.
Dr. Nicolelas, could you explain, the role of the Bolsonaro administration, the steps that he's taken that have made the crisis as bad as it is? You've called him public enemy number one.
Well, yeah, basically he has done nothing. Actually, he has played on the side of the virus down here in Brazil, because since the beginning, he downplayed the severity of the pandemic and was on TV, on social media, everywhere, talking, you know, every day against any measure of social distancing, mask using, or even against vaccines. Throughout the first year of the pandemic in Brazil. So he basically has transformed this crisis into a political, ideological battle. And according to everyone that is involved in studying the pandemic and trying to see what happened with this crisis in Brazil, he is the main enemy of any attempt to control the pandemic in the country.
And also, you know, during the course of this 1 year of this pandemic, Brazil has had no less than four health ministers. But I want to ask about something that's very striking about the demographics of the people who've been worst affected by the virus in Brazil, namely that there are a lot of young people who are hospitalized and who are dying, which is quite different from what we've seen in most parts of the world. So could you explain what's happening? Why are so many young people getting sick and even dying?
Yeah, well, during the first wave, we saw the pandemic being focused on people above 60, 65 years old. But since November last year, the demographics of the now that we got from hospitals and from ICU analysis is that much younger people are being admitted to the hospitals and to the ICUs. And in fact, at the largest ICU facility in Brazil, here in São Paulo, at the University of São Paulo, you know, a hospital with more than 230 ICU beds, what you see now is that the age group more affected and the one that is dying the most is between 35 and 40 years old. This was a tremendous shock, and this was compounded by the discovery a couple of weeks ago that Brazil is also suffering from an epidemic of premature deliveries. So pregnant women are being infected at a record rates down here. It's leading to premature deliveries and babies that need to go to ICUs all over the country. So for the first time in history, we are seeing ICUs for babies, newborn babies, completely full in Brasilia, in states in the southern part of Brazil. So we have seen a dramatic shift in these demographics. And some people are blaming the new variant. Others are saying that more young people are violating the isolation rules that have been imposed in many states in Brazil. So it's basically a combination of both factors, I think.
Dr. Miguel Nicolelis, earlier this week, six cabinet ministers resigned, including the foreign minister, who some considered the worst foreign minister in Brazil's history. Many blamed him for failing to get enough vaccines by compromising ties with China, with Russia and India. Can you talk about the significance of this and how it is that Brazil, that really was a testing site, right, a place where clinical trials were performed a lot, has so much difficulty getting vaccines?
Yeah, this is a crisis that has been created by many fatal mistakes by the Bolsonaro government. And the foreign secretary was one of the worst in the cabinet, and certainly the worst foreign secretary that Brazil has ever had, probably since imperial times in the 19th century. What happened on Monday was unprecedented. You know, the only episode that is close, but not even close, is back in 1977 when the general in charge of the military junta that was governing Brazil fired the defense minister who was plotting a coup d'etat. And that was a very particular night in Brazil in 1977. But never in Brazilian history, the heads of the Army, Air Force and Navy were fired on the same day. This was a shock. And for 48 hours down here, we are not sure whether there was a sort of a coup being plotted and put in place by Bolsonaro. So The armed forces have now strongly denied that they, you know, want to support any adventure in that direction, and in fact have rebutted the president by saying that they will always follow the constitution. But in a country that has suffered a coup d'etat in 1964 that lasted 21 years, a military coup d'etat, every Brazilian remembers the disaster and the death toll of that period in the country.
So, this is the anniversary.
Yes, and this was exactly on the day of the anniversary of that coup d'etat. So you can imagine how people were feeling for these 2 days here. And yesterday, the tension reached a very high level until the, you know, the new defense minister announced the new heads of the Army, Air Force, and Navy. And it's still unclear what is going to unfold in the next few days.
And Dr. Nicoleles, you've talked now about the role of the administration, various members of Bolsonaro's administration that have led to problems, to say the least, with the handling of the pandemic. And I'd like to ask more about the rate and scale of vaccination there. The news just emerged yesterday that one of the vaccines that Brazil had ordered 20 million doses of, that's the COVAXIN COVID-19 vaccine developed by India's Bharat Biotech company, that those 20 million doses, the health regulator in Brazil has said that vaccine doesn't meet Brazil's manufacturing standards. Could you explain what happened and what vaccines Brazil has access to?
Well, right now, the vaccination rollout has been a total disaster. Brazil has always been, in the last four decades, one of the best countries in terms of implementing national vaccination programs. The World Health Organization has always used Brazil as a, you know, the poster boy of a good national policy for vaccination. At this moment, Brazil has vaccinated with one dose about 8% of the population, as, you know, about 17.8 million doses, which is way below the target of the national immunization program that was unfolded in December. Right now, Brazil has access only to the CoronaVac, the Chinese vaccine, and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. However, we heard this morning that about 50% of the doses that were planned for April are now not available. So we basically have dropped half of the doses that were supposed to be delivered in April. So regarding the Anvisa, the Brazilian regulatory agency, Brazil has a very high standard of approval and for vaccines. You know, it has followed this policy for, as I said, for many decades. And at this point, we are not clear what happened in this latest decision. This has not yet been published, the details. So we are waiting to see what happened in terms of the regulators, because the people involved, at least at the technical level, are really well equipped to make this decision. So, but we are not sure if there was any political interference at the highest possible level.
And finally, Dr. Nicoleles, the effect on the indigenous population of Brazil.
Well, that's a tragedy inside of tragedy. We started reporting on this in our committee back in May of last year, saying that the numbers were already above the national average of infected people, and still nothing happened. The number of deaths were above the national average, and the government didn't take any measure or any attitude. So we reported this nationally and internationally for close to 10 months. And
we have the 5 seconds.
Oh, and the numbers, you know, keep growing. So it's a tragedy inside of a tragedy.
Dr. Miguel Nicoleles, professor of neurobiology at Duke University, former coordinator of the largest scientific COVID-19 task force in Brazil, has been in Brazil for the last year, speaking to us from Sao Paulo. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.